So we started this series. This is a four-part series that leads up into Passover. This is actually something kind of coming from Passover, but it has applications far beyond that, as Passover does. But there are four cups of wine which are poured and drunk in a classic Seder in Passover. And each one of those is specific to something that happened to the Israelites, but it's also because they are, you know, part of us and we are part of them. I mean, we got grafted in. It's also part of our lives and our Christian walk with the Lord. So it is applicable beyond all this. And we are very much a church that believes in the full Bible. There are some churches that kind of really, you know, well, we're all New Testament all the time. We take a larger view than that, and we believe in the Old Testament. And in fact, we had a Messianic Jewish rabbi say this, and I think this was pretty brilliant. The Old Testament is the New Testament concealed, and the New Testament is the Old Testament revealed. So they really do play together like that. And so so I, you know, kind of want to, you know, don't just slough this off, well, that's Passover. No, this is Christian life. And so last week we talked about the sanctification cup, which means to be set apart. And that sermon is online. I had a lot of people come up to me after that sermon, and at first I thought they were complimenting me, you know, and then I thought later that actually what they were saying was, we didn't think you had that sermon in you. So, you know, I guess it was a compliment, but it was considered a good sermon, I think, by most. So that's online if you haven't had a chance to see it. But this week we're going to the second cup, and this is the cup of deliverance. And this specifically comes from this this in Exodus. And actually, we started with this phrase last week, and we're going to finish it this week. I am the Lord God, and I will bring you out. That was the sanctification cup. From under the burdens of Egyptians, I will deliver you from their bondage. So last week, we talked about sanctification, and this week, we talk about deliverance. Just give me a second on that one. Watch who knows this movie, okay? You all need to repent. That's an evil, wicked movie, but that's Deliverance. So, that's a weird movie. You'll never look at pigs the same after that movie. But so, not that I've seen it, no. But so, how did Israel get into bondage, though? And that, you know, how, in order to deliver them, we kind of have to know how they got there. So give me a minute. I'm going to back up, and I'm going to give you the history of how they got there. And I don't know if this is going to surprise some of you, but when I first did this, it sure surprised me, because I always thought that the Egyptians somehow captured them, you know, like some nets or something, I don't know, and pulled them into bondage. You know, isn't that how you would get into bondage? Isn't that how you picture someone being pulled into bondage? That's actually not what happens. It starts with Joseph, which is, you know, a series we did last year, I think, from Dream to Destiny. We talked about Joseph's story, but abbreviating it a lot, he was sold as a slave, and the slavers took him to Egypt, where they sold him to an Egyptian named Potiphar, who was up in the palace guard, very high-ranking Egyptian official. He served well in Potiphar's house. Everybody loved him. The wife took a liking to him, tried to seduce him. He says no, and so to get back at him, you know, she cries rape and gets him arrested and thrown to prison, where he will be for 10 years. Didn't do anything wrong, completely not his fault, but he's stuck in prison, falsely accused. And so he's there for 10 years. And then after that, he gets out in a miraculous way, because Pharaoh has this dream and no one can interpret it for him. And so they're trying to find somebody, and this person knew of Joseph, and he had this knack for interpreting dreams. And so they go get him. They pull him out of prison, clean him up real fast, throw him in front of Pharaoh. And Pharaoh says to him, I hear you can interpret dreams. And Joseph interestingly says, no, I can't. God interprets dreams. But I'll be happy to ask him for you. You know, if you want, tell me your dream. And so he tells him the dream, and Joseph not only interprets it, he goes further, because everybody's sitting around. The dream is basically saying this horrible famine's coming, and it's going to last for 7 years. And everybody's stunned by that and stuck trying to figure out what to do. And Joseph says, well, I'll tell you what you should do. And he starts telling them what they should do next, because Joseph had those kind of gifts. And Pharaoh gave him some credit, recognized talent when he saw it, and said, well, you know what? I'm putting this guy in charge. You know, he's the only one of us that has a plan. So they put him in charge, and he does a great job. He's not only smart, but he's also moral, which was a perfect combination for that job. And he not only saves Egypt, he saves all the land around it, because everybody was suffering from the famine. And in fact, part of the people he saved were the very brothers who sold him into slavery, because they started coming to Egypt to buy grain. And when Pharaoh finds out that that's his relatives, he said, well, this is crazy. You ought to bring them here. And so he does. He invites his entire family to come over to Egypt where they are honored guests. They give them the best land. They set it aside to them and said, here, have it. And that was always God's plan, because God had this tribe of people, you know, it's a bunch of families and very small, straggly things, and he moves them into Egypt, and in Egypt, they have nothing to do. They don't have to train for warfare. They don't have to, you know, fight off all the skirmishes. They are surrounded by the most powerful nation on the planet, Egypt, and they are protecting them. So they can relax, and they get busy, and they multiply. And so before very long, they have all kinds of people there. And then they're going to move eventually from being honored guests to despised slaves. And what happens is the Egyptian pharaoh looks and says, there are more of them than us, and they're strong. And if we get attacked, like from the Amorites or something, and they decide to pick up the Amorite side, we're going to be fighting a war on two fronts. And so they became very, very afraid of what happened. Now, Moses, who writes the story of Exodus, really doesn't tell us much detail. He leaves it to other authors of the Bible to come back later and fill it in. The first one's a psalmist. He comes by in Psalm 105 and says, Israel came into Egypt, and he caused his people to be very fruitful, and he made them stronger than their adversaries. They actually became stronger than Egypt from living with him. And then he turned the Egyptians' hearts to hate his people, and that's when they got afraid of them, and then to deal with them deceptively. And that's an interesting word. They deceptively dealt with them. They didn't grab them and pull them into slavery. They deceived them. And then in Acts, we see the rest of the story. This is Stephen giving his great sermon, greatest story, sermon of his life, and last sermon of his life. It's so good, they kill him afterwards. They can't take it. And when he gets this part, he has a little bit more texture. He says, at the time the promise was approaching, which God had assured to Abraham, the people increased and multiplied in Egypt. And then there arose another king over Egypt who knew nothing about Joseph, and this man dealt treacherously with our people. And if you look at that word, it actually means to circumvent by fraud, to be tricked. And so what we get is a picture that comes from the psalm and from Stephen is that the Israelites were tricked into bondage. They weren't taken into bondage. They were tricked into bondage. And that's an important little note, because if you don't know that, it's like, well, why would God send them to Egypt? They're just going to end up in bondage anyway. You know, that doesn't make much sense. That was a good planning, God, but they weren't in bondage because God sent them to bondage. They were in bondage because they got comfortable in Egypt. See, they were allowed to leave Egypt for years. In fact, the last chapter of Genesis, they do. They all get up and leave Egypt. And they leave Egypt because Joseph's father died, and he wants to be buried in the Promised Land. And so they pick him up, and they take him over, and they bury him. They're all out of Egypt. The Pharaoh said, yeah, go ahead. You know, and so they all go do that, and then they came back. But we're kind of getting to the point right now where they don't need to be made a nation anymore. They are a nation. They need to get out. And they just got a little bit comfortable in Egypt. And so when Pharaoh came to them the first time and said, you got this great choice land here, and you're a powerful people, we need you to start earning your keep and start working around here. They had two choices. They could have left or they could have stayed. They chose to stay. And the reason they chose to stay is because things are pretty good. There were people trying to get into Egypt. They were already there. Why would we leave? Well, you know, God does have this place for you over there that he set aside for you. How about going back home now? You're good. No, we'll just stay right here with the Egyptians. We're having a good time here. This is pretty good life. Well, it turned eventually not into a very good life as they started slowly increasing the bondage. And in fact, when Moses first shows up, they don't even know they're in bondage. They think they can still leave. They're shocked to find out that Pharaoh won't let him go. In Proverbs, there's this proverb, a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come like a thief, and your need like an armed bandit. Just get a little comfortable. And before you know it, you're trapped. There's a story I heard once about an Eskimo couple. This is many years ago, but this was one of these arranged marriages as they were done in these tribes, because they had this like central area and then everybody lived out in these little ertz and igloos and things on the outskirts. And so they got married, they came into the area, and they had this celebration, and then the wife and husband kind of meet each other for the first time and get put in the dog sled and heading back out to where the cabin is. And on the way, they're going there, all of a sudden he throws her out of the sled. She doesn't know what that's about. But she gets up and she dusts herself off and gets back in the sled, and she's thinking, did he really just throw me out? And a little while later, he throws her out again. He says, now I know he threw me out that time. I just know. And he gets back in the sled. And it goes on for a very long time. And then before you know it, he throws her out again. Only this time, when she goes to get back in, he starts mushing the dogs again. So she'll run and he'll mush and she'll run and he'll, all the way to the cabin. She made him run all the way to their cabin. Well, when she got there, she was loaded for bear. I mean, she goes in there and stomps in and throws off her furs and looks at him and says, my father never knew who you were when he arranged this marriage. And I can tell you, this marriage is over. I'm sleeping in a bed. You're sleeping on a floor. And then tomorrow, we're going back down and I'm going back to my dad's house because there's no way I'm going to live with a man who's as cruel as you are. He says, cruel? I saved your life. She said, what are you talking about? You threw me in the snow 3 times. He says, yeah, because you fell asleep in the sled. You can't fall asleep in this wind. You'll die. You've got to keep the ark going. And I tried twice, and you just wouldn't listen. And so I finally had to make you walk the whole way because there was no other way to get your heart pumping. If I hadn't done that, you would have died. You were too comfortable where you were. Sometimes I think that as Christians, we just want comfort. You know, we're kind of always going for a place and trying to find comfort. And we do that with our entire life. It's like we have this idea that if we're in God's will, our life will be comfortable. And if things are going bad in our life, what do we think? Well, I must not be doing something right. God must be punishing me for some reason. Right? We're working this out in my life because I'm not comfortable anymore and things aren't good. So it must be that. And that's not biblical. God never says, look, I'm going to save you and you're going to be comfortable for the rest of your life. It's not what he says. Certainly not what you see in the New Testament. Jesus says, I don't have a place to lay my head. When he was killed, they had to put him in a borrowed grave. He had nothing. Jesus didn't live a comfortable life, neither did any of the disciples. And yet we have this idea that that's the ultimate goal of Christianity, is to be comfortable. We seek it in our churches. I pray to God we're not a comfortable church. We try not to be, believe it or not. We try very hard not to be a comfortable church. We've come from them. We've been in them before. And they're nice, right? Comfort's nice. It's nice. We would go, you go in there, and you would say hi to people you know. That's always great. And then you'd sit in your assigned seat. Okay, it's not assigned. Your name's not officially on it, but you guys know what I'm talking about. You had a seat that you sat in always, right? And the people around you were always the same. And so you kind of got to say hi to them. You got very comfortable. And when the preacher would start and the service would start, you knew it was going to happen. There's an order of worship that you're going to follow. Everything's nice and comfortable. And there were times you had to stand up and speak, but you memorized those when you were a kid, so you're very good with that. Everything was very, very comfortable. The preacher preaches a little sermon. Pray to God he doesn't go over 20 minutes, 15 or 10 minutes in some churches. And then, you know, out the door, you know, maybe 3 scriptures be talked about or something. And you say, shake the pastor's hand, smile and wave. And as soon as you hit the car, man, you can check that off your list. Did church today? Yeah, you know. And by the time the tires of your car hit your driveway, you've forgotten anything that might have been said there. But you're comfortable, you know. And we went to church like that for a long time. You know, and church becomes all about your friends and a routine that you're comfortable with. And we try very hard not to be that. And the reason we try very hard not to be that was shortly before we opened Spirit Chapel, I came across this really scary verse in Revelation where Jesus talks about that church. And I always thought that was the purpose of church. I'm a preacher's kid. I grew up in that church. You know, I was always in that kind of a church, always looking for that church where I felt comfortable, felt good, you know. And I could just kind of slide in, sit down, and have an easy time of it. And then I read from this verse in Revelations where Jesus is talking about a bunch of different churches. And he comes to this one. He says, I know your works. You are neither cold nor hot. I wish you were cold or hot. That's a weird thing. You know, why would Jesus wish a church were cold? But no, you're not. You're lukewarm, he says. And I, you know, reading this, I'm thinking, well, lukewarm's not bad. You know, lukewarm's better than cold. Surely on a scale of cold to hot, lukewarm's better, right? It's better to me. Must be better to Jesus. But Jesus goes on and says, but since you're neither cold nor hot, I will vomit you out of my mouth. And when you read this in the old King James, it says spew. Spew doesn't sound so bad. You know, I will spew you. Spew you actually sounds like a euphemism, doesn't it? Spew you. You know, it's like, just doesn't sound so bad. So what the word actually means here, if you look at it, is, I'm not trying to get too gross here, but to vomit with extreme force. Jesus isn't saying it makes me want to throw up in my mouth a little. He's saying, you make me so sick. I got to get it as far from me as possible. Have you ever been that sick? You know, ate something or drank something you shouldn't have had, and the next morning maybe you're like, oh man, you just want to get this out. You want to get it as far from you as possible. That's what Jesus is saying. This makes me so sick when I see it. I want to throw it as far from me as possible to get it out of me. Because why? Because you say, I am rich. I've become wealthy. I have need of nothing. Isn't that the ultimate goal of most Christians in America, though? Isn't that exactly what they're looking for? He said, you don't know, though. You're wretched. You're miserable. You're poor. You're blind. You're naked. And I tell you, I'll give you gold refined from fire that you may really be rich, and garments that you may really be clothed. Here's your problem. You've got trash from earth, and you think it's enough. I'm trying to give you riches from heaven, and you're not listening to me because you're happy with your trash in earth. Listen, there are a lot of people in bondage who don't know it. And we don't think that. Usually when we think bondage, we think addictions. You know, and listen, I have counseled with people who have drug addictions and alcohol addictions, and they'll tell you they're in bondage. They know they're in bondage. I don't worry as much about them. I worry about the people who are like the Israelites in bondage in Egypt and don't even know it. Because you get comfortable and you get stuck. You know, the only thing, the difference between a rut and a grave is two ends. And we get caught in these ruts, and we're okay with it. Because it's comfortable, you know. We're all right with that. That's what we want to do. But we have to understand that when we get stuck there, getting out of there is not only not easy, for us it becomes impossible. Now, we probably all know somewhat of the Exodus story and where Passover comes from and where the term Passover comes from. But he gives us these instructions that you're supposed to take a lamb and you're going to keep it till the 14th day, and then you're going to kill it at twilight. And then you're going to take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and over the top. See, there's one thing I think we forget when we talk about, oh, God deliver us from bondage, and we sing the songs, and, you know, I sing the songs too. I love them. My chains are gone. Listen, escape from bondage comes with sacrifice. There was a sacrifice that got them out of Egypt. And for us, the sacrifice is the blood of Jesus, blood of the Lamb. There was a price paid to get you out of bondage. What's incredible is how many people want to have the chains struck from their wrist, but they don't want to leave. That describes an awful lot of the Israelites. We see that because they keep wanting to go back. You know what? Wasn't so bad there. Now that we got this thing worked out, maybe we should go back. And I know a lot of people who basically are saying, look, I'd love to be out of this addiction, but don't ask me to change. I don't want change. Just get rid of this. My life's great, Lord. If I just wasn't hooked on OxyContin, I'd be great. You know, my life's great. If I just didn't have this, I could stay. That's all I need. If you could just change this one thing, I'd be fine. And Jesus is saying, no, you don't get this. I paid a price for you. And I paid a price for you to take you out of bondage, not to keep you there. And so then a lot of us blame sin. We don't want to tell Jesus that. So we say, well, the problem is I keep sinning because I can't help it. Oh, I'm weak, Lord. You know, or the sin's too strong, the temptation's too great. You don't understand. I have a hard time with this, right? And Jesus addresses this. He said, well, let me tell you something. If your right eye is making you sin, here's what you do. Pluck it out. Throw it away from you. It's better to lose an eye than the whole body get thrown in hell. Or if your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off, throw it away. It's better to lose your hand than to go to hell. Now, obviously, Jesus isn't asking us to pluck out eyes and cut off hands, or I would be blind and I would be walking around on stumps. The purpose of him saying this is he's saying, look, you got to get serious about this. I remember when I came across that scripture in Revelation where I saw what he did to the lukewarm church. I call it the halfway church, you know, halfway righteous. And I remember I put down the Bible and I looked at it and I said, God, why? Why are you so upset with the half righteous people? And I did not expect an answer, but I got one. He says, I didn't go halfway to the cross. See, Jesus is all in for you. Blood was spilled for you. And we're sitting there saying, yeah. But the problem is my sin. You don't know, Lord, it's just too hard for me to beat this sin. And so we tell him, that's all well and good, but this is just too difficult. And I don't know, I just keep falling, and I can't tell you why. My father preached a sermon. My father was a preacher, and I grew up in his church. My father preached a sermon many, many years ago, and I was a high school kid at the time, and it just really hit me hard, this sermon. It was about Samson. And I didn't realize until I heard that sermon how many times Delilah had tried to get Samson to give him the truth so she could steal his strength. It wasn't like one time. It was several times. And the Bible even doesn't, they tell us three times. They tell us there were others. I'm like, how in the world does he still go to her bed? You know, he's still there. How does he do that? This is the dumbest thing. And then my father preached this sermon, and it kind of really struck home with me. And that was when I was, like I said, high school, just learning how to play guitar and stuff. So I wrote a song about it. I'm not going to sing it this morning. not for least of which, it turns out when I was younger, I had, must have had a higher voice because I can't hit any of these notes. But I want to share the words with you from this song that I wrote about my dad's sermon. It was really, really his thing. But it goes like this. Behold Delilah as she stands in the night, so radiant, so beautiful. Oh, what a sight. To see her is to want her. To know her is to crave. This woman has no friends, only enemies and slaves. What strength it must take to resist her charms, and it's strength that's not measured by the power of an arm. Now, Samson, I know you are feeling hard to beat, but I wonder if you're ready for this kind of deceit. Now, you listen to her pleadings long into the night, resisting temptation, yet put up a good fight. Oh, you can fool anybody, but Samson, not your inner self, because you know, as I know, you are doomed to fail. See, your choice was made, and it was long before this time. You already lost the battle raging for your mind. It might take a while now, but that's only for the books. Your choice was made when you took your second look. You see, she's wicked and deceitful. She's the devil's chosen bride, and you think she wants nothing of you? Don't be stupid or blinded by some foolish pride. If you listen to her, you're through. And now you cry out in anguish, please understand, I can't help but listen, even though I know it's wrong. Well, then don't heed my advice. Go ahead, Samson. But Samson, don't blame Delilah when your strength is gone. Samson, do not blame Delilah when your strength is gone. You see, sometimes, like Samson, I am feeling quite strong, almost like I'm daring temptation to sing me her song. But of course, if I listen, I'm fooling no one. The battle's waged, the decision made, long before the deed is done. And the snake is in the garden, and Delilah is in her room. Temptation is hanging there, like a lingering perfume. What's that bookmark on your browser? What's that locked in your bedstand? How can we fight the battle with the enemy in our land? Yeah, she's wicked and deceitful. She's the devil's chosen bride. And if you listen, she'll call to you. Don't be stupid or blinded by some foolish pride, because if you listen to her, you're through. Now, you can cry out in anguish, please understand, I can't help but listen, though I know it's wrong. Well, then don't listen to me. Go ahead. Go on. But Christian, don't blame your Delilah when your strength is gone. Another way I could put this, and maybe this is maybe more powerful, is this. Don't stand in front of Jesus and tell him the blood he spilled for you isn't enough. Because that's what we do. We say, you know, I know you've forgiven sins, but not my sins. You have no idea what my sins are like. I know you help with temptation, but not my temptation. You can't help me with this. It's too great. It's too strong. Nobody could resist what I am doing. And then you're calling them a liar, because in Corinthians, Paul says this, no temptation's overtaken you, but such what is common to man. In other words, Paul's saying this, oh, wait, you're tempted? Dude, we're all tempted. All right, maybe he didn't say dude. I don't know. Apostle Paul probably didn't say dude. But is this what he's saying? He said, we're all tempted. He said, look, it's common. He said, but God's faithful. He will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you can endure. But with temptation, he always provides a way out. Always. And by the way, this is like one of the most misquoted verses in the Bible, because this is when people say, God will never give you more than you can handle. This is what they're referring to, and that's not what this verse says. Nowhere in the Bible does it ever tell you God won't give you more than you can handle, just so you know. What he tells you is he'll be there with you. He often gives us more than we can handle, so we have to rely upon him. Right? Just as an aside, free sermon there. But anyway, he says, you'll never be tempted beyond what you can bear. There's always a way out. Don't tell him his blood wasn't sufficient. That's not how it works. God will take the chains from our wrists, but if we don't leave a cell, what difference does it make? There are Christians all over who have the chains struck in from their wrists and just stand there. I'm good. The rifts were chafing. I'm cool. I'm okay. I like my cell. I'm safe here. I'm comfortable. Do you want to be free? This is actually something that Jesus asks all the time. when he goes up to people. He went up to this guy in John, and this guy sitting at a well and by a fountain, and this was like known to be a healing fountain, supposedly. If the water moved, the first person in would get healed, you know. So the Bible never tells us if that's true or not, but they believed it, so they're all there, and this guy's there, and he can't get there. And so Jesus walks up to him, and this guy's been sitting there for 30-some years. You know, every day they'll take him and put him there. And Jesus walks up and says the weirdest thing. Do you want to be healed? Do you want to be well? Do you want to get well? Somebody actually asked him, do you want to be well? What a weird thing to ask somebody who's been sitting there for 30 years. But he's been free so long, sometimes we get so caught up in our bondage, we're okay with it. And so it's a fair question for Jesus to say, do you want to come out of Egypt? Do you want to come out of your bondage? Do you want to be well? Or you just want this fixed? That's not being well. Do you want to be well? How about that? Do you want to be well? And he says, I can't. I love this. This guy is like the most cantankerous person I think Jesus heals. He's like almost angry with Jesus. I can't. My stupid son-in-law put me too far from the pool. I can't get to it. I'm stuck. I can't get well. And he's sitting there in front of Jesus Christ telling him why he can't be well. We do things just as stupid, though. And so Jesus says, just rise up then. Pick up your pallet and walk. And so he does. And he begins to walk. It's just amazing. But we can't just stop there. And Jesus tells us this. We have to be really careful not to stop there. Deliverance is not a destination. It is simply the start of our journey. When he came and delivered the Israelites out of Egypt, it was to take them to the promised land, not to get them out of Egypt. Oh, you guys are good now? Okay. You need me in the future? Let me know. Here you go. Can you imagine? No, he had a purpose for the deliverance, and he has a purpose for your deliverance as well. And so there was a bunch of Pharisees, of course. They're very worried about Jesus by this point. You know, this is starting to happen where Jesus is getting so much attention. And they've told everybody, if anybody acknowledges Jesus is real, we will throw you out of the temple. And so they find out about it, and it turns out, you know, that he healed him on Sunday, on the Sabbath. And that can't be right. God can't possibly work on the Sabbath, so he can't be from God. And so they try to say, well, who did this? He said, I don't know. It was a drive-by healing. It just hit me so fast that I didn't even see him. You know, well, I don't know who did this wicked, awful thing to me. You know, I have no idea. He slipped away. And so a little bit later, Jesus sees him in the temple, and he comes up and says, behold, you have become well. You told me you couldn't, but behold, you have. I love Jesus. He's just like, look at this. Look at you walking. Now, watch what he says. Don't sin anymore so that nothing worse will happen to you. That's a scary verse, isn't it? I healed you. Stop your sinning. And what does he mean by that? Well, there's obviously something that this man had, a sin, a deep sin, dark sin, that he couldn't let go of. That's what he's talking about. We all fail and fall short of the glory of God. But there's some sins we just stubbornly refuse to give up. And Jesus keeps telling us to, and we just say no. So he healed him. He says, you know what? Something worse can happen. There were many forms of bondage. And so this man, he goes away, and what does he do? He tells on Jesus. Oh, I heard, he's over there. That guy who was doing the healings, you want to stop? He's over there. He turns him in to the Pharisees. Why would he do such a thing? For crying out loud, why would you do such a thing to a person who just healed you? Well, we see in John tells us, look, there are many, even the rulers that believed in him, but because of the Pharisees, they weren't confessing him for fear they'd be put out of the synagogue, for they love the approval of men rather than the approval of God. See, this man's bondage wasn't his lameness. That was a symptom of it. His bondage was he loved men more than he loved God. That's a bondage a lot of people I know have. They care very much what other people say about them. Couldn't care less what God thinks. And so Jesus is saying, you got to be careful. I didn't do you any huge favor if you don't get out of this. If you stay where you are, it's going to get worse for you. It's because what happens if we're free but we stay there? You know, what does happen? Well, he tells us this too. He says, look, when an unclean spirit goes out of man, and a lot of his healings had to do with taking demonic power away, right? But a lot of it also has to do with us allowing influence in our lives by sinning. And you know, we see this in when Paul says, be angry but do not sin. Because when you do, you get the devil a foothold. So we can give power in our lives. Not all illness is this way. But some of it is, and clearly this man was. And Jesus says, look, when I throw away the evil spirit and allow this healing to take place, what will happen is it passes through waterless places seeking rest. Bad news for the demons. That's why they hated seeing Jesus coming. But he doesn't find it. And then he says, you know what? I'll return to that house that I just came from. That's the man. And when he goes there, he finds it's unoccupied. It's just swept and put in order. Jesus came in and cleaned house. And it's just still sitting exactly the way he left it. Well, now it's even better. So he says, okay, let me go get seven of my friends, all of whom is worse, party at this house, and they all go there. And now you're worse off than you were before. Jesus is warning us, when I strike those chains off of you, it's for a purpose, and the purpose is for you to leave. You're just going to sit there? Worse things are going to happen to you. When God frees you, he expects you to follow. Now I'm going to really quickly go through this. But there's another, in John, another guy, and this guy gets it right. This is one of my favorite healings in the Bible. I guess I don't really rank them, but this is certainly one of the favorite healings in the Bible. So this guy is blind, and this time it's not because of his sin. And we know that because specifically the disciples asked, is this because of sin? He says, no, it has nothing to do with sin. He was born without eyeballs. His eyes were born closed, right? This is a kind of a famous ailment of the day, and we've even seen it today. You know, it's just kind of a birth defect. And so he sees this guy, and I want you to put yourself in this blind guy's footsteps or sandals for a moment, because here's this guy, and he hears Jesus coming. Now, he's heard who Jesus is, but he's never seen him, of course, and so he's sitting there, and so he kind of probably gets himself all ready, you know, hopefully Jesus will notice me, you know, fix his hair, he's all ready, and he hears everybody walking in the crowd, and all of a sudden, somebody stops, you know, two sandal shuffles right next to him, you know, and he's waiting, and what's going to happen? Is Jesus going to speak or anything? And instead, he hears, you know, this guy's spitting. What? And he takes the spittle and he puts it with clay and he makes this and he puts it in his eye. I just want to point out that the last time the Creator's hands touched clay, he was creating man. At least in the Bible that we know. Right? I actually literally believe Jesus made an eyeball for him. Uh-oh, you're missing an eyeball. I've done one of these before. You know, and he sticks it in on his eye and he says, now go wash this in the pool of Siloam. And so the guy goes away and washes and he comes back seeing. And of course, he never saw Jesus, and he's gone. And the neighbors and those who previously saw him as a beggar were saying, hey, isn't this the one who used to beg? I love this because it's like they all start talking about, no, that's not him. Oh, yeah, it is. And he's like, hey, right here. Yeah, I'm standing right here. Yes, that was me. I didn't see before, but now I do. And I said, well, how'd that happen? He said, well, this man called Jesus, don't know what he looks like, he anointed my eyes, which is putting it delicately, and said, go and wash. And I went, and I came back, and I have sight. He said, well, where is he? He said, I don't know. Another one of these drive-by healings Jesus was so good at, right? And so you know, they said, wow, that must be amazing. So they go running off to the Pharisees to tell him because, again, this is the Sabbath. You know. And so they go and they tell him and say, well, this can't be happening again. They rush to find this guy and they pull him up. And they said, well, tell me again how this happens. And so he tells them the whole story, just like he told the people before. And he put this stuff in my eyes. I go, I wash it. I come back. Now I can see. And the Pharisees said, this man can't be from God. Because he did this on a Sabbath. It just can't be. And so the Jews didn't believe he'd been blind. They said that if he's not from God, he couldn't have done it. If he couldn't have done it, this can't be true. This is some gag. So they go get his parents. They said, this son of yours who was born blind, that guy there, was he really born blind? Now they're scared to death of him, these guys. They're scared to death of him. Watch what they say. They say, he's our son. We'll testify to that. How he got sight, we have no idea. We don't know who did this wicked, evil thing to him. They gave him his sight back, right? We couldn't tell you. But I'll tell you what, he's old enough, ask him. You know, get us out of there. And so they go get him again. And they said, tell us now, is this guy, do you think, from God or not? And the man looks at him and says, whether he's a sinner, I don't know. Now, this guy's never been in the temple before because they wouldn't have let him in there because their belief was he was blind because he was sinful. So we've never been in the temple before. So here he gets to see the Pharisees for the first time, right? He says, I don't know if he's a sinner. That's your stuff. I'm a beggar. He wouldn't even have been educated. He probably couldn't read. How could he? Right? So, you know, he's just this ignorant man who was a beggar. He says, I don't know if he's a sinner. That's your world, not mine. But this much I know. One thing I know. I used to be blind, and now I see. I love that. I only know one thing. I'm healed. I know that. And that's really enough. And they said, well, how did he do that? He said, look, I told you before. Why do you want me to go through this whole thing again? Are you trying to become disciples of his now? And they said, no, you're his disciple. We're disciples of Moses. As for this man, we don't know where he's from. And he said, well, that's an amazing thing. I love this guy. He's like, you guys are killing me here. You don't know where he's from. But he opened my eyes. Didn't see any one of you righteous guys opening my eyes. Didn't see that. And these guys are stumped. And by the way, just so you know, a man with a theology is no match for a man with a testimony. You can say whatever you want about this, that. You can analyze Greek and Hebrew all day long. Or science facts, whatever. If you've got a testimony that's like this man, all I know is I used to be blind, but now I see. There's nothing anybody can say about that. The testimony will always beat the theology. I'm just encouraging some of you who don't think you can witness because you don't know enough scripture. Do you have a testimony? Because that's what people, that's what we're called to do, by the way, witness. We're not called to preach, we're called to witness. And so he says, you know, no, I can't believe you guys don't know. And then he goes on and he gives them a theology lesson. I love this. He says, look, we know God doesn't hear sinners, right? But if anyone is God fearing and does his will, he hears him. It's real simple. I don't know why you guys can't figure this out. It's real simple. Since the beginning of time, this miracle has never happened. I mean, there's been all kind of miracles that have gone on, but eyeballs being put into heads has never happened before. Since the beginning of time to this, we've never seen a miracle like this. Elijah couldn't do a miracle like this. Since the beginning of time, we've never heard of it. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. What do you mean you don't know if he's from God? See, we get caught up in all our little rules and we try to say this must be truth, but it isn't. And they said, look, you were born entirely in sin. That's what they believe because he was born blind. You're not going to teach us anything. And they kick him out. And Jesus comes by and sees him later too. And he says, do you believe in the Son of Man? That's the phrase for Messiah. Do you believe in the Son of God? Do you believe in the Messiah? He said, who is he, Lord, that I might believe in him? And Jesus says, you've both seen him and he is one talking to you now. And he says, Lord, I believe. And he worshiped him. I'm not going to let anything take this from me, he says. Listen, Jesus came to deliver you, not to make your cell more comfortable. We have to understand that the blood of Jesus was spilled to deliver you from your bondage. Not just to take the chains off of you, but to take you out of your cell, out of Egypt, and to God's promise for your life. That's why he came. Anything less is not taking God's blood that was spilled for you seriously. Would you all please pray with me?